The Financial Sense In-Depth Report with Jim Poplava features a midweek in-depth look at the financial issues of the day with guest experts. Here is your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, there are many ways that you can make money in the market. A lot of individuals and much of Wall Street spend time on looking at fundamentals, P.E. ratios, cash flow, where's the economy heading. There's another group that looks at charts. What are the charts telling us and what are the chart patterns predicting in terms of where the market's going? And yet there's another group that does neither. It doesn't forecast where the market's going, nor does it look at fundamentals, but it's called trend following. In the remarkable success of its adherence is what we're going to be talking about today. Joining me on the program is Michael Covell. He's written a book called Trend Following, Learn to Make Millions in Up or Down Markets. And Mike, I wonder if you might give us a little of a backgrounder to your book. A lot of our listeners may be familiar with the movie Trading Places. It was a movie very similar to a real-world bet between two partners of a successful trading firm. Tell us about Richard Dennis and his partner, William Eckert.
Well, I still think it's the most inspirational story on Wall Street about making money. And it started off with a guy, a self-made guy, and this guy's name was Rich Dennis. And he was a 20-something trader trading in the pits in Chicago in the mid-70s. By the age of 25, he had made $1 million. And he kept trading, and he kept doing really well. And by the early 80s, he had accumulated a fortune of nearly several hundred million dollars. And his partner looked at him one day, and his partner said, "You know, Rich, you're a savant. You're just brilliant. No one else can do what you do." And at the time, he was right up there with George Soros in the early 80s. He was a well-known guy. And Rich was like, "No, you know what? I've got rules that I use. I've got these specific rules, and anyone can learn them." And his partner's like, "No way." They put ads in the paper, Barron's, Wall Street Journal, etc. They asked for trainees. They said, "Listen, come to Chicago. We'll train you if you're selected. We'll give you a couple weeks training. We'll stake you with some funds, and we'll put you in an office down the street. Go to work." Well, that's what they did. And they brought in, thousands of resumes came in. I think they interviewed about 50 or 60 people, and they narrowed it down to approximately 20 hires over 2 years. And these were just people with random backgrounds. We're talking people, there was actor. Now, I don't say this in a joking way. One guy was a drug dealer. One guy was a broker. I mean, there was two women involved that were trainees. So it was a really diverse group, and they gave them 2 weeks of training. They gave them specific rules, and the specific rules told them, okay, here are the markets you're going to follow. Here are the rules that tell you when to buy. Here are the rules that tell you when to sell. Here are the rules that tell you how much, you know, to buy or sell, because we've all got limited capital. You have to manage your money. And at the end of 4 years, this group had made approximately $100 million profit. So it really proved that nurture could trump nature, that you didn't have to be born with these genetic gifts. And the great thing about the story was that he nicknamed his students the Turtles. Hence, I created a website back nearly 15 years ago called Turtle Trader to kind of really educate people about this great story and these rules that they were taught. And these rules were trend-following rules.
Well, let's begin with some of the very important tenets of your book, Trend Following. You've got two categories in your first chapter. One is an investor versus a trader. And number two, fundamental versus technical. Let's talk about those concepts.
Well, I think everyone, we hear the term investor, and I think everyone kind of knows what that means. It's like, hey, I'm going to buy something in the hope that it's going to go up and we're going to make money. And there's nothing wrong with that, and there's plenty of fortunes that have been made that way, plenty of fortunes. But we've all seen in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, sometimes when you buy something, it doesn't necessarily go up forever, whether that's stocks or real estate. Well, a trader looks at the world a little differently than an investor, at least by the way I would define it. A trader says, look, I'm in this to make money. I'm not in this to be right. You know, if the market is going up, I want to be long. I want to be a buyer. And if the market's going down, I want to either be out of the market or I want to be selling short and making money if the market drops. And to me, those are pretty big distinctions. I frankly think we'd all do better in our lifetime if we started classifying ourselves as traders versus investors. And some people might say, well, Mike, that's a quibble, but I'm not so sure. Now, in terms of technical analysis versus fundamental analysis, once again, most people are familiar with fundamental analysis, even if they don't use the term. they know, well, I want to buy Apple stock, so I better do my homework to find out what's the gauge on how many iPhones are going to be sold in Singapore. And you do all these factors, and then you make a guess, and you say, well, I think the price is going to go to 290 by this date. It might happen. It might not happen. I do know that we can all look at the examples of the last 10 years and say, well, there's been a lot of forecasts like that that haven't exactly worked out right. Now, technical analysis, it kind of gets a little complicated because there's two forms of it, if people have heard of it. And most people hear about technical analysis and they hear about, well, you know, I'm going to follow the chart. Let the chart tell me what to do. And if the chart has a particular pattern, if I follow that pattern, then hopefully I can make a prediction as to where the market is going to go. I would call that a predictive technical analysis. Well, the other form of technical analysis, which is what this trend following is a reactive form of technical analysis. This technical analysis is about looking at the price data. It's not about the fundamentals where you need to know crop reports or whether it's going to rain tomorrow or, you know, you know what OPEC is doing. Technical analysis is about looking at price data. But instead of looking at this predictive price data where people come on the TV and they say, well, this chart pattern means this is going to happen and I predict such and such. No. Trend followers say, look, we're going to follow the price, but we don't know where it's going to go. So if the market, I mean, I think your audience can sit there and say, well, gosh, we all know if we look back in time, if Apple, and I keep using Apple, but if we saw Apple trading at 60 and then it goes to 250, I don't think any of us really care why it went from 60 to 250. I don't really care how many iPhones were sold. I don't care about any of that. All I care about is it went from 60 to 250. And a trend follower would say, well, if you got on board at Apple at 60 and you don't know anything, you're blind, you're deaf, you're dumb, you don't know anything, but if you're on board at 60 and it keeps going up, well, stay on board and don't ask questions. Just keep going and let them follow the market along. And you always have to have an exit strategy here. Trend following, there's no holy grail, so you can lose money. And, you know, you might make a bet. Maybe you buy Apple at 60, it goes to 50. Uh-oh, got to get out. Got to get your exit strategy and get out. So that's, I hope I'm not being a little too long-winded here, but there's just covering some of those basic areas you just asked about.
Now, in a lot of these trend trading systems, they generally use a mechanical trading system that's based on an objective and an automated set of rules. You talk about the turtles and Richard Dennis. He had a set of rules that he operated on. Contrast that to, let's say, discretionary trading systems.
Well, a discretionary trading system, there could be people out there, let's say someone's got an economics background and they've done their homework, they worked at the Federal Reserve, and they feel like they understand the macro picture enough to make a discretionary decision to say, I would like to buy this market here and I think it's going to go there. And they make that decision. It's a discretionary decision. Whereas what Dennis would do, Dennis would say, here are your rules and here's your portfolio and here are the markets you're tracking. And if oil goes from 70 to 75, and the rules say to buy it at 75, you buy that market at 75. You don't ask any questions. You don't debate it. You don't say, well, that doesn't feel right to me today. You buy it at 75, you put your stop in, and you go with it.
And one thing that you talk about in your book, and I think this is very, very difficult for a lot of people to understand, and that is the inevitability of change. Why is recognizing that so important? Because people don't like change. You know, we get up, you drive the same way to work each day, you have routines, and it's the same with investors. They look at the same charts, they look at the same fundamental data, but, you know, if there's anything we've learned over the last three or four decades, the world changes whether we like it or not.
It does, and it happens fast, and it's very unpredictable. And as sure as we're sitting here having this conversation, we both know that at some point in time, whether it's tomorrow or a month from now or a year from now, some inexplicable, unpredictable event will happen. And we will all go, oh my, oh my. And the markets will take off either one way or the other. And with knowing that kind of change is always around the corner, I think the trick to trying to make money is how do you respond to change? What are your rules to change? Well, if the markets change, if something moves, if something happens unexpected, what plan do you have? I think one of the things the trend followers do that's great is they always know before they ever take a position, before they ever take a trade, they know when they're going to get out. So I don't think a lot of people necessarily look at the markets that way. I think a lot of people will say, which is still some of what we saw in the 80s and 90s, which is the buy and hold mentality, which is, okay, I'm going to buy it and just hold on. The trend followers say, okay, well, I might buy it, but I know when I'm getting out before I buy it, which is great for helping to respond to change.
You know, one of the most important pieces of information in trend trading is price. It trumps all other information from, I don't care whether you're looking at P.E. ratios, crop reports, economic studies. Price, as you talk about, makes the news, not the other way around, is commonly held view in the markets today.
Well, it's true. There's a very famous technical analyst that lives in La Jolla, California, named Richard Russell. And a lot of times people say, well, they'll talk about unemployment or they'll talk about some economic factoid of the day, and they'll talk about how those things drive the markets. And Russell always says, well, no. The stock market's driving us all. If the stock market craters, that's going to drive what happens in the economy. If the stock market craters, that price movement is going to force everything else, not the other way around. And on the reverse, if the stock market takes off, for example, if we look back at the dot-com bubble and how much money was generated in profits and capital gains taxes for governments, there was a huge confidence boost between, let's say, 95 and 99, just because the stock market was taking off. The stock market drives it. The price drives it. And I think that's the distinction I'm making there in the book.
In your book, you talk about psychology and some of the things that are very important to top traders. I want to read a quote here. You talk about Charles Faulkner. One thing, explain who he is, but he says the first rule of trading is to cut your losses and let your profits run, and then that it's the hardest thing to do, doing the hard thing by going against human nature. This is where the discipline comes in, the psychological preparation, the months of system testing that give the trader the confidence to actually trade against his natural tendencies.
Well, you know, we don't want to lose money. No one wants to lose money. But one of the things, and this is what Charles Faulkner is getting at, is to pull off what you just described. You need to put money into an abstract world. Money is a means to keep score. So if you know money is a means to keep score, and you know you're trying to find those big trends out there, but you also know that trying to find big trends means you're going to have a lot of small losses. This market's going against me. I have to get out. I have to take my loss. I mean, the only thing we can really know before we take a position, the best risk control that any of us really can know, how much are we willing to lose? We can know that. We don't know where the market's going to go, but we know how much, and we can control how much we're willing to lose. And if you can get yourself to thinking like that, well, you're really a step ahead, as Charles Faulkner talks about.
In your book, your second chapter, you kind of document great trend followers. One is Ed Sirota. And there's a line in your book where he goes, when you stop trying to please others and concentrate on pleasing yourself, you gradually become aware of what you are passionate about in life. And when that happens, all sorts of people come out of the woodwork to help you achieve your goals. And he's referring to Bill Dunn is proof positive of that statement. Let's talk about that.
Well, and you're actually, I think you're bringing up a non-market-specific point, but I think it's really important that I think so many people wake up and they go through life and they say, well, I'm going to do this because my dad said to do this, or my parents wanted me to do this, or this was the job that I should take after I got the degree in college. Versus if you wake up and maybe there's something as a small child that you really love to do, and you stopped doing it or you walked away from it. And I think what Ed is really getting at, and I've met Ed, and he's a really, really, really interesting intellect, is follow your passion. Follow your passion. I mean, I have a passion my passion really has been for nearly 15 years is to explain trend following. I still feel like I'm wandering around in the desert with no one listening while all these fantastic traders continue to do really, really well. But I have a passion in trying to let people understand the subject. And I think everyone's got a passion that they can follow through on. But you got to let go of all the other barriers that hold you back and not worry too much what other people say. And that wisdom you mentioned about when you do that, all of a sudden, it is amazing. People come out of the woodwork that you would never think that you would connect with. And all of a sudden, all these people are there to support you and help you along the way as you chase your passion.
One of the successful traders that you talk about in your book is John Henry. And there's a chapter headline. It's what you think you know that gets you into trouble. And Henry knows that the complicated, the difficult elements of trend following are not about what you must master, but what you must eliminate from your market view. For example, the overwhelming desire to act in the face of adverse market moves. He talks about avoiding volatility really inhibits the ability to stay with a long-term trend. And long-term systems do not avoid volatility. They patiently sit through them. Boy, that's a hard one.
It's hard. For myself, my account, it's really hard. I mean, it's extremely difficult. I'll give it a great example. I might have even shared this with you before on the phone, but there was a trader, a gentleman out of London. He's a trend-following trader. And he was short the S&P for most of 2008, and he was running a sizable fund. And he came into September. He was still short the S&P, and he was trading a weekly bar system, meaning he only looked at one price point per week, and it was a trend following system, and it was all price based. And he came in, and I can't remember when the TARP was announced, maybe the 19th or whatnot, but it bounced up, and here he is in the short position. The S&P all of a sudden bounced up, so there's a lot of volatility. But his stop was far enough away that it didn't hit his stop. So all of a sudden, I guess the TARP was announced, the market liked it for a day or two, then came roaring straight back down. And then we all know what happened in October of 2008. And this particular trader that I'm mentioning, by willing to accept that volatility, he made 40% on a hedge fund that I think was around $200 million in October of 2008 alone. And that was because he was willing to sit through that volatility. Now, it could have gone against him. He might have had to take a loss, but he knew what that loss was going to be. He was willing to accept that loss to play the game.
You know, in the turtles that studied under Richard Dennis, there was one in the group, a guy by the name of Jerry Parker. And I think not only was Jerry good, but I think his genius figured it out that if you're managing money and you do have, you know, volatility, you have drawdowns in your account, he figured out that the average investor just wasn't subject to or could handle the kind of drawdowns that, let's say, a Richard Dennis would trading his own account, because he knew what, in the end, his rules would play out. Let's talk about Jerry Parker, because he modified leverage to temper drawdowns, and he's turned out to be one of the most successful turtles.
Well, it's true, and we should take a back step on the kind of profits that the turtles used to generate, some of the returns. They would have returns where they would do 100% a year. They had some phenomenal returns. But they did employ a very high degree of volatility, and they used leverage. And what Parker did is when he finished his training with the turtles and he went out on his own to start trading for clients, he kind of realized, wow, you know, I'm not so sure my potential clients really want to make 100% a year with the possibility of losing 40%. So in having your trading account, you know, over the course of a year, go down 30, up 50, down 20, up 100, that's pretty volatile stuff. And what he did was he dialed it all back. He took the same principles and decreased the leverage, and has had a very successful career allowing trend following to reach investors with less volatility in the returns. Now, on the flip side, you might have some listeners that say, well, you know what? I'm willing to take greater risk. I'm willing to take the higher volatility because I actually want the higher rewards, and it becomes a personal choice. It really does.
You know, one of the things that I think all of us need to assess, and this is something that Richard Dennis did when they were sort of interviewing the turtles, there was a turtle selection process that Dale DeLutri, who was one of Dennis's executives, and some of the questions they asked the potential candidates, they wouldn't be the typical questions you would have in an interview if you were, let's say, trying to get a job at Goldman Sachs. Let's talk about that, because really what they were looking for, at least from the way I viewed it, was people that could think outside the box.
Absolutely. They were looking for people that could think in terms of math was one of the things that people who are logical thinkers, people that didn't necessarily walk in, you know, trying to profess their market knowledge or whatnot. They wanted people that could think outside the box, that could draw a logical inference, for people with a background, a games background. There's a backgammon player, there's some chess players. They wanted people that could think in an abstract type world. Because the moment you start viewing money as the way that you can go buy the new Lexus, you're cooked. If you're going to be successful at this, money has got to be a way to keep score. And it can't just be, you know, what nice hotel I'm going to go to in Vegas, or what restaurant I'm going to go to. And Dennis was looking for people that had that personality, perhaps, that was not as preoccupied with that. Quite a few blackjack players, and so it was a really interesting mix.
Let's talk about, probably he's considered the father of trend trading, and it's Richard Donchian. And he really, this is what I found remarkable. He reminded me of Thomas Edison, experimenting, and finally, after 1,000 attempts, he invented the light bulb. Donchian didn't really hit his stride until he was in his 60s, when things really began to come together and click.
Yeah, he actually, this was a very famous trader. He was working with Shearson, I mean, back in the 40s and 50s, and he had gone through all the various approaches, fundamental analysis, and I believe he stumbled onto an older writer or trader from the early 20th century, and then eventually he started to realize, wow, these trend-following type rules are really, this is what's really working. And the amazing thing is, there's almost like, I almost call it like there's a lineage here in the trend-following world, and a lot of it starts with Richard Donchian, because you can look at a lot of top traders, and ones that I cover in my book, guys like Richard Dennis that we're talking about, or Ed Sakoff, Bill Dunn. These are people that were actually highly influenced by Richard Donchian. So they were looking at his work in the 70s, and then saying, wow, we're going to build some trading systems off this. We're going to build some trend-following trading systems. And that's what happened. So he's a great influence.
You know, a lot of people would like to become speculators, and we've heard stories about, the Jesse Livermores out there. In your book, you talk about one of the essential qualities to become a speculator, and you list five of them: self-reliance, judgment, courage, prudence, and pliability. Let's talk about those and how, grouped together, that's what really makes a great trader.
Well, they do. And I think pliability, I think the ability to adjust, I think that's probably the most important thing. They have this ability to adjust and adapt. If you can't adjust and adapt, you're just going to be toast. I mean, a small example, I was not exactly happy yesterday with some short S&P positions. But you have to make an adjustment and take your lumps. And I'm not going to say I'm courageous for doing that, but I think that's what Livermore is saying. You have to be willing to say, well, okay, I don't really have anybody standing behind me. I've taken this position. I have to adapt to the changing conditions. And I have to have the courage to make the decision. And courage is to make the right decision to perhaps take a loss when the market's going against your preset plan. Have the courage to take that loss. Because if you don't have the courage to take that loss, then you could just be a very sad person if your account melts down. So it gets back to following the rules. And I think a lot of those, the ones you just mentioned from Livermore, these are things, though, that really aren't even market-specific, really. These are life-specific. These are things that you should just be doing in your life in general.
I want to talk about the concept of volatility versus risk. Trend followers, as you talk about, have greater upside volatility and less downside volatility than traditional, let's say, equity indices such as, let's say, the S&P, because they, number one, exit their losing trades quickly with preset stop losses. Let's talk about that and how that works in a market. And I want to bring an article that just appeared on Bloomberg today, and it was about hedge funds having a very difficult time because they just can't figure out where the market's going. And a lot of them are just sitting on cash right now. The name of the article in Bloomberg was Hedge Funds Frozen in the Headlights, Scale Back Trading. Let's talk about this.
Well, I'll talk about the hedge funds first, then go back to volatility. The hedge funds that I am familiar with are not frozen in the headlights. They're following their strategies, following the risk management, taking their exit signals, taking their entry signals, and waiting for markets to trend heavily in their favor. And that's the nature of trend following. It's a very patient wait-and-see type thing. So I think the Bloomberg article, like a lot of articles these days, is usually written by a 26-year-old kid who's got a literature degree who doesn't really know what he's talking about. That's a different story, though. So, but in terms of the upside volatility, that's kind of a little bit of jargon that I put in my book. But to try and explain it for your listeners, let's imagine that you take a position and you take, let's say, you buy, you buy Google at 400 a share. And you know, okay, well, I'm going to get out if Google retraces and goes back to 360. That's my stop. Well, if Google goes up to, let's say, 500, a lot of people might say, well, let's tighten up the stop. Google might bounce around. You might take your position at 400, it goes to 500, it goes to 550, it goes to 450, it bounces around. And see, some of that volatility is on the upside of your entry position. So, I mean, it doesn't really make a difference. I'm not the greatest expert here on some of the ratios, but one of the most popular ones is the Sharpe ratio to quote, measure risk. What the Sharpe ratio does, though, and like I said, I'm not a Sharpe ratio expert, but what it does do is it penalizes you if you have upside volatility. So let's say, for example, you take a position at 400 and, you know, the market goes up to 500, back to 450, up to 550. The Sharpe ratios, and if your performance follows that kind of volatility, if the performance in your account, your trading performance, and this is where trend-following hedge fund managers get burned sometimes by these ratios, is somebody will say, well, these guys, look at their volatility is too strong. But what if the volatility is on the upside? What if the performance volatility is on the upside? You're well above where you got in. It doesn't really make a difference because you can't predict markets. And I think some of these things that try to put a tight glove on markets are predicated on the idea that you can predict what's going to happen as markets start to move. And I the example you're bringing up with the volatility is for me, is really, really critical because we can't predict anything. All we can do is react.
Let's talk about something that occurs in trend following and something that I guess a lot of investors sometimes have difficulty, and that's drawdowns. Why don't investors, for example, invest on drawdowns? One of the things that happens, at least in our firm, Mike, is when gold goes up, we get lots of calls, or oil is up. When it's down, when you might want to invest in a, let's say, in a drawdown period, people do just the reverse. They stick their head in the sand. And you talk about in your book, some of the great investors in your book had drawdowns where, I can't think of which trader it was, one of his biggest clients, who he had made a fortune for, they went through a drawdown period. Guy pulled out all of his money. Following 2 months, I think the investor was up 80-90% or something like that. Why don't investors invest during periods of drawdown? In other words, add to the account because you know what follows generally is an uptick.
Well, that's the emotional discipline. That's the hardest thing for any of us to do. I mean, if you make an investment with an advisor, and let's say you put $100 in, and your $100 turns into $60, I mean, isn't your first thought really isn't, well, that was some normal volatility for this manager? Your first thought is, wow, I'm down 40%. Maybe this is going to zero. I better get out now and save what little I have. And I think that's the natural human emotion. But with trend-following traders, if people understand the strategy, you know, a strategy that is based on having a lot of little losers trying to set yourself up to get a big winner. They're often, markets are like rubber bands. They can only stretch so much. So, you know, as a trend following trader, you could end up having a period of time where the markets don't go your way. They don't trend, but you're still having to try and take positions. And those can end up as small little losses. And those small little losses added together equal the drawdown. But the interesting thing about trend following trading is that when the big trends happen, those big trends pay for the drawdowns. They pay for the small losses and then some. And people might say, well, gosh, I don't like that style of thinking. I'd rather just buy something low and sell it high. Well, once again, it gets back to the hard issue, which is buying low and selling high hasn't worked that good for a long time. And I implore people to, you know, this might sound very foreign, some of this mentality, this trading mentality of the trend-following trader. But it's probably something where people really would serve them well to take a peek at something quite different than buying low and selling high.
I want to move on to something that's probably on the minds of a lot of investors, and especially through, you know, looking at the lens of what has happened over the last couple of years. Let's move on to big events, crashes and panics. You know, anytime you have something like that, the media, I mean, today's a good example. The media is full of stories of telling you everything that is wrong right now, and usually when you have a crash, the stories that appear are this hedge fund blew up, this investor lost a gazillion dollars. But what they never focus on, Mike, is who's on the other side of the trade. In other words, if this hedge fund blew up and lost billions, who was on the other side of the trade that made billions?
Well, I'll give a kind of a fun story, a little bit of color here, instead of you and I being as textbook as we've been. Back in 1995, I was trying to put this whole trend following story together. And in early 1995, I'm sure some of your listeners remember this, there was a Cavalier guy out of Singapore named Nick Leeson who lost, basically he blew up the Queen's Bank, Barings Bank in Singapore, and, you know, $1 billion loss for this bank. And, you know, he was in the futures markets. And he was basically making leverage bets on the long side. Well, in the futures markets, it's a zero-sum game. So if somebody is betting one way, there's another person betting the other way. Well, the person that was betting on the other side of Nick Leeson is the current owner of the Boston Red Sox, a trend-following trader named John Henry. And I just really happened to be in a random conference with three or four men in a room in London in 1995. I was sitting behind like the CEO of Repco and Dean Witter, and they were having a conversation about who was on the other side of the Nick Leeson position. Now, mind you, at the time, the only thing on the cover of Time magazine was a picture of this guy being led away in handcuffs saying how he lost all this money. And it wasn't until my book came out 7 or 8 years later that I was able to piece the story together and say, well, yes, he won, but in all actuality, what really happened was it was a zero-sum transfer, essentially, to John Henry. And if you really want to be frank about it, the losses of the Queen's Bank in England were used to buy the Boston Red Sox. When big events happen, not everyone loses. When big events happen, there's a winner. And it's kind of like we talk about John Paulson and the real estate. You know, real estate melts down. Well, John Paulson was prescient enough. He looked ahead to the future to know, hey, I want to make some bets here to capitalize when real estate crashes. And that's a smart strategy. And I think what happens in the media is we fixate on the losers. We fixate on the losers to a terrible degree, whereas I think it's much more important to find out what the winners were doing.
Some would argue, whether it's a John Paulson or a George Soros when he shorted the pound back in 91 and 92, that this was sort of like a chance event luck. But as you document in your book, whether you look at the stock market crash of 87, the peso crisis in 94, long-term capital management in 98, 9/11, the credit crisis of 2008, if you look at these great trend traders, whether it's Bill Dunn, John Henry, same results. So how can you explain that as luck?
Well, take, for example, the summer of 1998, long-term capital management, the great hedge fund, all the Nobel Prize winners and the former guy at Salomon Brothers, and they were doing all this astrophysics, who knows what, engineering, reverse engineering, they're making a ton of money. And, you know, no one, once again, nobody was really talking about trend-following traders, but then all of a sudden, long-term capital management blows up. They're just gone. The great story that's making everyone all this money, and they were on the covers of all the magazines, but at the exact same time they were losing, and they were taking positions in all the big liquid markets, and all of a sudden they got whacked. Well, it was the traders that had systems that were predicated, and this would be the trend-following traders, and they, once again, they won a lot of the losses that long-term capital management lost. But when you have a trading strategy that says, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where anything's going to go. And so when an unexpected move happens, it's the funny thing about unexpected moves. They usually don't just happen at one precise point in time. They usually start earlier. And maybe it's not a, take for example back the 2008 S&P move over the course of the year. The S&P was drifting down over 2008. Now we had a big, massive move down in the fall, but it was already moving down. So trend following traders, by their very nature, are usually on the right side of surprises, because surprises usually don't just happen at a finite point in time. There's usually some buildup, whether it's a slope, whether the position is going up or down, there's usually some movement ahead of the final blow-off. And when the final blow-off happens, that's when the press of the losers gets hard, and then as I point out in my books, the press of the winners is usually never discussed.
How do you explain Victor Niederhofer? A lot of people viewed him as a trend follower. What went wrong there? He was thought to be one of the top guys in his field. Was he really a trend follower, and how did he blow up?
I don't think he would describe himself as a trend-following trader. I think he, very similar to long-term capital management, and I'm going to generalize for both of their strategies. The strategy of Niederhofer and long-term capital management was to show you a percent or two positive every month. Their clients were paying them to deliver 1% to 2% a month. And it's nearly impossible to really do that unless there's a lot of option strategies, a lot of selling of options. And it's a high-risk thing. And so you can maybe put together a 2-, 3-, 5-year track record of showing clients, oh, well, here, look at our track record. We made 1% or 2% every month. And clients are like, well, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean, this is what Bernie Madoff was showing his clients. I make 1 to 2, I make a percent every month, and he'll raise billions of dollars because the human mind wants to say, well, my gosh, that's fantastic. 1 to 2% a month, no down months, the greatest thing since sliced bread. I've got a simple, I really truly believe this. If anybody ever shows you a track record that shows you, let's say, 3, 5 years, 6 years, whatever, and it shows 1 to 2% positive profits each and every month, no down months, I'm going to say either that firm is a scam or that firm is poised to blow up because it just doesn't happen. Now, I'm not trying to be cocky about it. I'm not trying to be smarmy about it. It's just the law of numbers. It just, you can't do it. And there's so much evidence out there to show that this is true. We were talking about three right here with Niederhaber and Long-Term Capital Management and Bernie Madoff. These were the guys that said you can make 1% to 2% each month. Well, one was a scam and two blew up. Now, trend-following traders don't make 1% to 2% a month. Trend-following traders can have wildly varying months because the markets are like a bucking bronco. You get on board and you don't know where it's going to go. So you might be down 4% on the month. You might be up 5%. You might be flat. You might be up 1%. You might be up 20%. You might be down 7%. That could be a six-month stretch of trend-following trading. But what's more real? Isn't it more real to say, well, that's what the market does. That's the real-life market. I'm on the bucking bronco, as opposed to the three people, you know, like a Niederhofer or a Long-Term Capital Management, where they're kind of trying to put a tight glove on it and trying to generate a return that clients will like, even if it's really setting themselves up for when the big event happens, they get blown out because the strategy is so non-robust. It just is just poised for failure.
Let's talk about something else, and this goes back even to the days of the turtles, and that's the importance of thinking outside the box. And you have a great quote here from John Henry. He said, people in both baseball and the financial markets operate with beliefs and biases. To the extent you can eliminate both and replace them with data, you gain a clear advantage.
Well, let's look at baseball. Now, it's somewhat hard. For a long time, there was a great book out a couple years called Moneyball, which went into these very issues of how the Oakland A's were using numbers, sabermetrics, to judge players. And the idea being was, and I'm a former baseball player, the idea being is if you had a fat catcher who didn't really look very athletic, but he got hits all the time and he got walks all the time and he didn't strike out much and he got on base, who cares that he didn't look like Alex Rodriguez? Because, see, baseball was always something where, you know, it was the Adonis athlete. How does that guy look? That means he's going to be good. Whereas the Oakland A's and the Boston Red Sox, to some degree, have started to say, you know what, I don't really care how the guy looks. What does he do? What are his results? And, you know, looking at the results and looking at the data. And the trend following is very similar. You know, you want to say, well, gosh, let's look at the data. What's the data that we can look at that we can truly understand? And it gets back to the whole fundamental technical debate, too. But John Henry would say, let's look at the price data. Price data is the one thing that can't be cooked. You can't fake the price data. There's price data on every market every day. You can't hide it with an accounting scandal. You can't make it up. It's the one thing we can trust. There's almost nothing else we can trust. And Henry is just saying, look, let's believe in that data. Let's use that data.
You know, here's an element that I think is so important. I don't care if you're an investor, technician, trend follower, and that's human behavior, controlling one's emotions. Because the truth is, when it comes to investing, people are irrational and seldom make rational decisions. And there's so many things that kind of sink people: lack of discipline, impatience, lack of objectivity, greed, fear, refusal to accept the truth, impulsive behavior, and sometimes maybe the inability to stay in the present.
Well, all those things. I mean, that's life. And as you say, it's not necessarily even related to the markets. I mean, staying in the present. I mean, the moment of now, that's where we're at. I mean, if an individual looks on their screen, looks at their brokerage account, that's the moment of now. I mean, we can only make decisions off now. We can react to what the market is doing right now. We can see the price right now, and we can make decisions off that. Everything else, I was having a conversation with someone about this the other day, but one of the great things about trend-following trading, and we've heard in the last bunch of years the concept of behavioral finance, and attempting to look at behavior and look at our biases. And trend following, by its very nature, has had these things that the academics are making commonplace talk today in Wall Street circles. It's been built in to the concept of trend following for 50, 60 years. The idea that, you know, we know we've got these biases, so we're gonna use a system that's, and we're gonna stick to the system, we're gonna have discipline, we're gonna follow our rules, and this is how we think we can make our money best. So that's the most interesting thing to me is we hear these discussions today, and I know you've probably done quite a bit of work and seen them, but how do you incorporate the concepts of behavioral finance? How do you, when someone, when a professor comes out and says, well, you know, we have this, you know, this particular, this hindsight bias, we're always looking to the past. Well, how do you incorporate, you know, it's one thing to take the academic mumbo jumbo, but how do you incorporate that to a rule that can help you make money? I mean, we might all love the cocktail conversation of talking about these various biases that the academics have put together. And I'm not just poo-pooing academics, except they really don't believe in trend following. That's where I think they've got a problem there, too. But you know, it's so vitally important that if you're going to think about the various ways that us as human beings react in the wrong way, then we need something that instills discipline upon us.
I want to talk about something that's equally important, and that is the ability to make a decision. A lot of investors sometimes are like deer in a headlight when confronted with volatility or unpleasant news. And you tell a story, I don't know if it was in Trend Following or maybe your other book, where this is really what made Richard Dennis. And him and his partner, they were in a trade that was going against him, and they had to make a decision. I think it was in the silver market, as I recall the story. Why don't you relate that story and talk about, you know, the ability to make a decision in the heat of battle is so crucial to winning.
Well, without getting too specific on it, it was just a situation where they were essentially in a position, it was going against them, and they had to decide what to do. And basically, they were younger, there was millions on the line, their firm was on the line, and they had to make a decision. And there wasn't really any time for, he had to take the data, Dennis is in the pits, he has to take the data that's in front of him and say, I'm going to do this now, or I can't control the next 10 minutes or the next 30 minutes. I can take all available data right now, and I can make the decision. And for that particular decision, that particular trade, which I outlined in my book, The Complete Turtle Trader, it really saved his firm, and perhaps even more so, galvanized him for the rest of his career to understand the critical aspect of making a decision. When it's time to make a decision, you have to make it. If you don't make it, who's going to make it? And if you don't make it, you could be broke.
You know, another important aspect that you talk about is critical thinking. So many times we're looking for the answer when really the most important thing is framing the question.
Well, yes. We talk about critical thinking, too. I mean, I would hope your audience, if they're listening to our conversation today, the first thing they should be doing is poking holes in everything that I'm saying. They should listen to this and say, okay, what has he said? That's not true. This is true. I'm going to poke this apart. I'm going to rip this apart. I mean, everything I'm saying should be open for debate, discussion, to rip it apart. We don't do that enough. I mean, everything should be open for discussion. It shouldn't just be that, for example, and I'm not a guy that makes market calls. I'm not a guy that's going to tell you where anything's going to go. I'm just going to follow along and hopefully we'll make some money. But I think sometimes if you think about a lot of the folks that make a lot of market calls, you know, do they really show up to justify the market call they made last year, today? And I think so many times these market calls get made and it becomes infotainment. That's just not the real way.
Now, one thing that you talk about in your book, Trend Following, and you've documented in other books, is the success of these people, whether it's in crashes, periods of extreme volatility, whatever the markets are, they consistently over a period of time have some of the most incredible track records. I guess, Mike, a question is, if this is so successful in the people that employ it, that are disciplined to follow it, are successful, why don't more investors use this approach? Is it human emotion? Because as we talked about, the difficulty of mastering emotions, using data instead of hunches or biases, all the things that we talked about that make people successful or inhibit people from being successful, human behavior, is that why?
I think it comes down to something that you might not expect me to say. I think it comes down to advertising dollars, okay? I mean, I'm sure you've appeared on various shows, and I've done shows, radio shows, and some TV. And, you know, trend following is not a sexy story. There's not, and it's very blunt. We're having a very direct conversation about very specific issues. There's not necessarily a lot of gray area. You have a trend following system. You have specific rules. You follow those rules. If you follow those rules, hopefully you do well in the long run. If you don't follow the rules, you're definitely not going to do well in the long run. But how does that really work if that kind of discussion happens on CNBC? I mean, CNBC and Fox Business, those are designed to have people to come on to look like maybe they've just taken a shot of adrenaline or drank 17 cups of coffee. And they're on there to tell you, what's going to happen in the next 5 seconds. And if they're wrong about that, they're going to tell you about the next 5 seconds. And that's infotainment. And so there's a lot of people that pay for advertising dollars to appear for these shows. So they've got to drive eyeballs. If somebody comes on TV, me, and I tell people, oh, by the way, listening to almost everybody on this show is not going to help your account. Most of the people on these shows really don't know what they're talking about, and they're frankly guessing, and I don't know what their track records are, and these call records that they're making, who knows? I don't really think I'm going to get invited back much, because it's just not taking a stab at the entire infrastructure of how money and markets are displayed across most people's eye lines these days. I mean, and it's sad. I mean, but that's the biggest reason. There's no education in these kinds of strategies in the mass public. And not only is it because of the media and it's just not a sexy subject that would generate a lot of advertising dollars, let's face it, it's a real slam also against the Fidelities of the world and the Janices of the world. I mean, those folks don't want strategies out there that are basically saying, oh, by the way, guess what? Buy and hold is not so good. Because in the last 10 years, the top 10 mutual funds have generated approximately 0% return and generated for those 10 mutual funds approximately $21 billion in fees. So no return, $21 billion in fees, 10 years. They don't want me, Mike Covell, talking about trend following and speculative strategies that might have a chance that don't involve buying and holding where they don't generate fees. So I think it really comes down to mutual fund fees and advertising dollars are probably the two biggest reasons why trend following is not more well known.
Well, I'll tell you, you've written a fascinating book, and you've written a book that preceded it, which was about the turtles. And I thought that was just some great, great information. The name of the book is called Trend Following: Learn to Make Millions in Up or Down Markets by Michael Covell. And Michael, why don't you give out your website and tell people what they can find there and talk about your previous book too.
Sure. The way it started was there was turtletrader.com, which was a website, and that was the first start. And then my first book was Trend Following. And then my second book was The Complete Turtle Trader, all about the turtle story. And then most recently, I had a film come out called Broke the New American Dream, which actually features a lot of these trend-following traders. And the second half of the film is really a lot of the principles that we've been talking about today. I'm really easy to find. You can find me at my name, michaelcovell.com. That's Covell.com. Or you can find me at turtletrader.com. Feel free for any of your listeners, drop me a line. I mean, at my websites, we're pretty straightforward with what I do. We do provide education in the forms of books and the film and training and educational courses. It's really just trying to get people to understand trend following trading.
All right. Well, fabulous book. It really opened my eyes to some various ways of looking at markets or even investing. The name of the book, once again, is Trend Following: Learn to Make Millions in Up or Down Markets by Michael Covell. Michael's been our guest. And Mike, thanks for coming on the program and joining us this week. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
You've been listening to the Financial Sense News Hour with Jim Poplava, sponsored by the PFS Group. The Financial Sense News Hour is for information and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell securities. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of Jim Poplava and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. As such, you should always consult a qualified financial consultant before making any investment decisions. Financial Sense News Hour will not be liable to any person for financial losses resulting from investing in any companies profiled or information provided on this radio program. The Financial Sense News Hour with Jim Poplava was produced by Steel on Seal Productions. Join us again next week for more in-depth investment news and analysis. This is the FSN Radio Network.